Succession number 10798, Reel 2.
Mr. Bradshaw, Reel 2.
Well, as I say, I was on watch till 8 o'clock in the morning with two watchers. We were in three watchers, the two watchers that came down at 8 o'clock. And we were told to have a good breakfast and get a bath, a shower, and put clean underwear on, white underwear and everything else. This is on the instructions of Peter Agnew. And get ready because we're hoping to be in action by midday, and therefore it's essential that we scrub nice and clean in case anybody got hit. So with that, we had a good breakfast, clean and everything else, put on new pants and clean vests and everything else. And 11 o'clock, there was no tots issued that day. Rum ration was stopped that day. And 11 o'clock, we then reported to our various battle stations, as we call them. My battle station, say, was in the main office, and I was allocated... Yeah, but in the main office, I was allocated to what was called the spotting aircraft frequency. And actually, during the action, the spotting aircraft did make a signal to say that there was a torpedo bearing on the port side of HMS Bedouin. This was in the fleet cord T-F-67 or whatever it was. And, of course, we screamed this thing out and... avoiding action, of course, the torpedo missed us, thank goodness. But it was shortly after that, and it must have been getting on for about one... The action started about 12 o'clock. Of course, all we could hear in the wireless was bangs and thumps and everything else. Other than the guns going off, we didn't know what was happening, really. But anyway, by 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, the chief decided that certain frequencies were required and some were no longer required. And one that was no longer required was a spotting aircraft because he'd probably run out of fuel by then and gone back. And so he said, get out the office and get down the mess deck, so go out the way somewhere. And anyway, I always remember this part of it because I thought, well, I'll go and see what the battle's like. And I walked out onto the break of the forecastle. The forecastle comes down and onto the break, what they call the break of the forecastle, onto the deck. And I looked out, and I could hardly believe this. It was like a Wild West rodeo with ships going round in a circle. I could see our own boats, and I could see these German submarines, these German destroyers going round. And while I was looking, this German destroyer, I always remember it had caps on its funnels, these cowlings on its funnel. And as I looked at it, he pointed his gun straight at my eyes and went bang. And I heard these shots go howling through the rigging and over the top of the boat. They never touched the boat. They went straight through. We had a lot of shrapnel holes in the boat when I looked around in the funnel and that. But I thought, oh, that's enough of the battle for me. I went back in and went down the mess deck. Well, down on the mess deck, the chief cook had also been kicked out of loading parties or whatever he was doing, ammunition party, and had decided to make sandwiches. And so with that, we started dishing sandwiches out to anybody who could spare a hand, except for the guns' crews, of course. You couldn't get into the 4.7 and plays a lot of that. But we took some up on the bridge. I always remember this, and the skipper said, get the hell out of here. So we dropped the plate of sandwiches and opted it out the way. But the skipper was there, Captain Gower, who's David Gower's uncle. He was up there, he's the gunnery officer. And all he wanted was Gower and the leading signalman, because he had his favourite leading signalman up there. Woodward, his name was. Leading signalman Woodward. And he didn't want anybody else on the bridge, anybody else down below on the next platform. So, really, as a young telegraphist for the Battle of Narvik, nobody wanted us. You know, everything was... I'd say by 2 o'clock, they'd then realised that it's no good queuing up with ammunition. You've got to keep putting your ammunition as a flow. And, then, you know, everything... That, and too many people sort of spoiled it. So myself and a lot of the younger people just sort of moved out of the way to make tea and things like that. Of course, by 6 o'clock in the evening, everything had finished by then. The actual action had finished, and it was then, of course, that we went up to Rombeck's Fjord to chase the last couple of boats up there. The Eskimo, she was in front of us. And as she turned at the top of Rombeck's into Vestfjord, these two German submarines, two German destroyers had gone up there, had turned and fired the torpedoes. So as she come round the corner, she caught one. And of course, it blew her bows off and considerable damage. But as she backed out, you know, give her a cheer as she backed out. And then, of course, we went in and just bang, bang, bang. But what had happened, really, these German destroyers had gone ashore, fired the torpedoes, and they'd all jumped off, gone up into the hill. So there was nothing there. And, of course, they were so badly damaged, I don't think they were ever able to repair them or do anything with them.
Did you see the Eskimo hit?
The Eskimo? Well, saw afterwards. You know, she was, her engines were all right. She reversed out and come out into Rombach's Fjord, and then we went by her, you see. And then, of course, after seeing that everything was cleared up in the fjord with these two destroyers and they were no longer active, we came out, and by then, this is when they'd pulled the Cossack off the shore. She'd run aground. And, of course, we didn't have anything in common. She was what we called a Daily Mirror ship, the Cossack. She was involved in the Altmark and things like that, although most of the boats were involved in it. But she was the boat that went alongside the Altmark, and she became what was known as a Daily Mirror ship. Well, not a very popular ship, really. And so we booed her. I don't think it meant maliciously at all. But the skipper got a rollicking over that, you know, that it got so many killed on board.
So a Daily Mirror ship was one that had publicity, you mean?
Not adverse publicity, but the Daily Mirror always used to flash these things out. The Cossack does it again and things like that. But the boats that worked hard and didn't hit the news, of course, they never appeared in the newspaper.
What do you remember after going into Rombach's Fjord?
Oh, well, coming out of Rombach's Fjord and back into off Narvik Bay, off of there we, you know, counted our losses and made repairs, and then, of course, there's no further action taking place. We dropped battle stations, went back into our three watches. But the following morning, I think the following morning was Sunday. The action was on Saturday. Well, the action was on the 13th of April. So if that was Saturday, on the Sunday morning, the Germans sent their planes over. And, of course, when they sent them over these fjords, you know, with the high mountains on either side, they'd just come over the top, do a swoop and drop the bombs, and they had a very good chance of hitting somebody, and they did indeed hit the Grom. Now, the Grom and the Bliskavica were two Polish destroyers that were working in Norway at the time. And, of course, they hit the Grom, and, of course, they killed quite a few on board, but you know, we picked all the survivors up and gave them our jerseys and things like that and dried them. But a few days later, the Bliskavica had also joined us. This would be a couple of days later while we were still there, and they knocked down one of these German seaplanes. But they had little trouble with them because as they picked them out of the water, they apparently shot them. In exchange for hitting the Grom, I think. Anyway, after that, of course, Narvik was part ours, and we then proceeded down to Bodø and Aldersness and all these other places. We landed the French Foreign Legion at one of them, Bodø, I think it was. While we were landing them, the bombers came over and hit a building on the front at Bodø. And when the smoke cleared, everybody come rushing out of this place. Apparently it was a local brothel as they come galloping out of there. Anyway, that was more or less the end of Norway. By then, of course, the Germans were slowly taking it all back again. My next memories, really, of Norway, other than patrolling up and down, was Olaf Olafsson. He was a resistance leader. And we picked Olaf up, took him to England, and having done whatever he had to do in England, organising his supplies and everything, we picked him up again and took him back. We landed him on the coast of Norway, Olaf, and in fact he stayed on the mess stick with the Sparkers, the telegraphists, and a fine-looking fella then. In 1982, we had the reunion of the Bedouin. It was the 40th anniversary of her being sunk, actually. And at the reunion, Olaf was there. And my daughter came with me. She said, what a fine-looking man he was. You know, tall, grey-haired and figure. And I always remember him that night as he got in this boat and rowed away into the darkness. But he survived all right. And that, I think, was about the end of the Norwegian campaign, other than for the trolling and convoying up and down the coast there and, you know, trying to egg the Germans into coming out. But we didn't have much success on that either. They wouldn't come out.
How did you know about the Polish seamen dealing with the Germans from the seaplane?
Well, it probably just talk on the mess decks, you know, that this had happened. Whether they did, I know they shot down a seaplane, but whether they had actually shot them, they always said that they'd no trouble with Germans, reshoot them.
Was the Bedouin hit during the dive bombing and bombing attacks?
Oh, we had shrapnel holes, but we never had any direct hits. Because during the action, when I looked around, I could see, you know, the break of the forecastle is the first funnel there. And the hole, you know, about a foot wide of shrapnel that hit it. In fact, we had one boy on board, a boy seaman. And, in fact, he was the only real casualty on the board. He was hit by shrapnel. But he was, of course, assisting with ammunition loading and that. But he was the only boy we had on board. Yet, no, we did. We never really got hit.
I think you were telling me earlier that you actually left the Bedouin in June of 1940. That must have been soon after you came back from Norway.
Yes, well, when we came back from Norway, and in fact we came back, we did a refit up at War's End on Tyne. While we were doing this refit after Norway, that was when the Kelly came in. You know, the Kelly with Mountbatten? She'd been hit. And she came up the Tyne there with the war truck to a loading line sort of business. But she made it up there. But we were in dock for about 10 days or something like that. But it was during that period that the Admiralty, in their wisdom, decided that the tribal class, well, in fact, every boat, every HM ship, really, had got 100%... what they called active service people. But the active service was not a true name, really, because what they really meant, there was 100% of pre-war sailors, and there was a hell of a lot of conscripts coming in, and they had to be integrated into a working vessel. You see, they couldn't sort of say, right, you new lads can have that boat. So what they did, they made it must have been about 50% cut on most of the boats. And I was amongst the crowd that was taken off, and 50% of these hostilities only came in, you know, to integrate with it. And by then, of course, I'd been passed for a leading telegraphist as well, which, of course, made me supernumerary to the rest of them. Well, quite a few of us being promoted, and so we had to get off anyway. And, in fact, when I left the Bedouin, I was given HMS Lancaster in charge.
Tell me about HMS Lancaster again, please.
Oh, well, HMS Lancaster was one of these American four-funnel boats. They were built mainly for the Pacific in 1916-18 period, and they were made for Pacific waters. They were part of the 50 that were given on a lend-lease business for bases in Bermuda that the Americans wanted. Anyway, I'd picked up leading rate then, so I was drafted to I was sent to Canada to pick this boat up. Of course, it had Americans on when I arrived there, and there's me, my first ship in charge, and I've got a bloody old tin can. Oh, what a terrible ship it was. But fortunately, when I arrived there, it had a chief on board, and this chief, he says to me, do you drink? So I said, yeah, I like a pint of drink, yes. He said, oh, well, I've got some stuff I'll leave for you. So I said, righto. He says, I'll give you... He said, do you like to drink now? So I said, yes, I'll have a drink. So he got a cup of coffee, and he put this bottle of gin in. I thought it looked like gin. And anyway, I drank this. I said, well, nice and sharp. I didn't know what it was. So he says, before I leave, he says, I've got a couple of empty demijohns. He says, we'll fill them up, and then you'll have a drink for a couple of years anyway. So I said, yeah, all right. Oh, anyway, when the night came, he says, tonight, the skipper and all the crowd are... This was in Halifax in Canada. He says, they've all gone. He says, so we'll get some hooch tonight. So we went along to the torpedoes, him and another fella, myself. Well, we went along to the torpedo tube. Now, swing these torpedo tubes out, open the back. We drew these torpedoes back. He gets a screwdriver, and he undoes this big nut, and out poured this liquid into that demijohn. Anyway, we took about a gallon out of each of these things, into these things, screwed the thing back, put the torpedo, took it back in the wireless office, put it at the back of the main transmitter, and that was it. It was only then that I found out that this stuff was wood alcohol. It was mess we were drinking, you know, in coffee. But actually, it was only about an eighth of an inch on a cup of coffee. And anyway, it lasted me for a long while, but I think one wonder what it's doing to me, that stuff. But anyway, we shared it out, we drank it. But the funny thing was, when we tested this HMS Lancaster with all the American stuff on it, the torpedoes, when he fired, and we plopped over the side and didn't go any further. And then when he did the depth charges, they went off with a bang and shot all the toilet rolls. They were filled up with toilet rolls, apparently. So, you know, that was Lancaster. She wasn't a very nice ship. Mainly doing minesweeping mine layers. Went up to Loch Alsh, and in Loch Alsh were the mine layers that used to go over to Elgin-on-Bight and around that area and lay the mines. Of course, we used to escort them there and be laying mines. They'd come and have a bomb at you and things like that. Remember the Agamemnon? She got hit, and the bomb hit her on the deck and shot out the side. They exploded in about 60 fathom of water. Didn't do any harm.
Where was that?
That was off Elgin. It was a mine layer. These huge mines they had on board. Anyway, we were shortly after the two or three trips of that, and I was given 7 days coming in from sea leave. That'd be about 1941 now, and I'd arranged to get married. So I was home, and I'd also volunteered for special service because I wanted to join Olufsen, really, in Norway, as well as radio operator. It was what I was really after. But anyway, this special service draft, it turned out to be combined operations. And off to Inverary I went. But before I went, I had 7 days leave. I came and got married on the 17th of April, 1941. And then we went into command operation. I was in bombardment units, spotting aircraft then.
This was in the early part of 1941, was it?
This was April 41, when by then I'd left the Lancaster. I wasn't on board really long. But it was because I'd volunteered for this draft. But it certainly wasn't command operations that I'd volunteered for.
What can you describe in detail the job that you had in combined operations?
Well, the job I had was spotting, going ashore, picking up the target. The idea was to pick up the target, tanks or troops or whatever, any barracks, if you... Well, it happened in Madagascar. I got to shore there and there was sort of army barracks there where we... I called on Lightning Lafori and we bombarded the place and things like that. Was the job that I had, was spotting. But it was... By then, of course, it was combined operation. We had a captain, a leading telegraphist, a telegraphist and a signalman was the actual party. But the leading telegraphist and the captain of the Royal Artillery were interchangeable insofar as he was supposed to be able to do the leading tells job and I was supposed to do his. But it wasn't all that difficult from my point of view as a telegraphist. I had a set on my back and that. And when it come to map references, well, of course, you've got a map. There's nothing hard about reading a map. Locating your target, asking for a shot, ups and down, and then get on your target, fire for a friend, bang, 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 bang. And so it does. This is what I did, actually, in Madagascar.
So you gave a six-figure map reference, yes. Like on an odd and
sorry, yeah. Hmm.
And you were telling me earlier that you were now in khaki.
Oh, yes, big boots and khaki. We still had naval hats on. Except for we had a tin hat as well, but we always wore our naval hats and we had naval flashes on our shoulders. We had Royal Navy and, of course, I had a wireless operator's badge, which was the wings with a star above and a star below, and an anchor on this one with one good conduct strike by then, I suppose, and, you know, to show I was a leading telegraphist. But other than that, it was khaki boots and heaviest things I've ever picked up in my life, a pair of army boots. Oh, we're also armed with the... I did a lot of work when I started with the various commando units. You know, there were 12 commando units that we were working with. And they gave us one of these dagger things, you know, these dirks, these commando dirks. But...
Where did you do that work with the commandos?
We did all this up in Inverary. When they were training these blokes... You know, we go with them and they do raiding parties. We did the spotting and things like that. All the commando units, the 12 of them all together. And in fact, I worked with every one of them except number 7. And number 7 commando, they were formed by the East Lancs and several other regiments. But they went out to the Middle East immediately. Whereas the others, the 1 to 12 except the 7, they... did exercises in Scapa and Inverary and that sort of thing. So I worked with them nearly all, though. And in fact, number 6 commando, I have a photograph somewhere with number 6 commando marching through Durban with 3 sailors at the back, and I'm one of them, in khaki, the hat on. Somewhere around I've got one. Yeah.
Was the first operation you did with combined operations the Lofoten's raid?
We went up to Lofoten, and did that, but I didn't get ashore up there anyway. I went up on the Princess Beatrice, the Dutch ship. We weren't required for that at all. We went more or less if required and weren't required. But the first real operational job that I was called on, really, was Madagascar. Diego Suarez.
You were telling me a bit about this earlier, but if you can repeat in detail what you were involved with in Madagascar, please. Now we've got the tape on.
Well, in Madagascar, when I landed there, of course, at a party, and we landed the night before, and then in the morning, 4 o'clock, I had the signal on my radio to say that we're coming ashore, and eventually we could sight the boats coming in. We then gave the targets that we'd like them to shoot at, preparatory to the landing, because we had to wait for the landing to take place before we started shooting. But as the troops of the first wave landed, then we called for fire on the barracks, and after that, we then moved forward with the forward troops. Well, we moved further than the forward troops. We were in front of the main most of the time. And eventually, we moved so far ahead that we were held up by this vessel, French sloop or small destroyer, whatever she was. I always think she was a sloop. She wasn't that big, really. And anyway, she had got some cannons there. She was firing and shelled us up. And, of course, when I radioed back to the Lightning and the Fory to bring a bombardment over, you know, to stop, knock him out. Eventually we did hit him, and, you know, the crew sort of got in the boats and went ashore. But that was sort of round the bay, long way up where they went, and we were down at this little isthmus to get up to Diego Suarez. And it was then that we were told that they'd like the Foo Party, that we called them Foo Party, Forward Observation Party, that they wanted the Foo Party to go round the back to this place called Orangi Point. So, of course, that's when I started off, and we got a Bren carrier to take us so far, wild, scrubby land and rocky and that. Of course, the Bren carrier, he shed his tracks. So I left Captain Knight and the driver there, and I said, all right, well, I'll proceed with my radio and round us to Orangi Point, and I'll contact for a shoot from there, because, you know, I'll leave those two there. All right, off I went. Of course, unfortunately, as I'm trotting along there, and they say it's a scrubby, jungly place, and I went down onto the beach, towards the beach, to, you know, really get to where I was going, instead of going across land where I lose my way, where I could follow the sea round. And then I walked into this gang of Frenchmen. The boat was there, and I thought, well, I might be able to use that boat. So anyway, I went, stood in front of them, and realised I couldn't do much else, and just said, alley up, and they looked startled, and I see this gun in front of them. And with that, took them back to the Bren carrier. It was only about half an hour back anyway. And we left the prisoners there for a while, because Bogey Knight, this captain, came with me, and we had a look at this boat to see if we could use it. So I said, well, I'll tell you what, there's another boat on that. I said, you look through your binoculars, you'll see there's another boat there. So I'll tell you what I'll do. It's in the book. I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. Leave my gear here, and I'll swim out there. So, anyway, in there it says... But
we'll mention this book on the tip, I think.
Yeah, but this captain, he said, well, there's sharks in this water. He said, I don't fancy that. I said, well, that's all right. The days I've spent stinking on this island, there's no shark going to attack me. He says, no. He said, I don't think you better do that. He says, so we'll go back, he said, and we'll have to think what we're going to do. Well, with this, we decided that he would keep four of these Frenchmen there, and I would take these other three and make my way back. Having then been in contact with the fleet signal officer, who was on the Ramillies, to say that what had happened, which he wasn't very happy about, he called me...